Welcome to Email After Hours by Senderscore, powered by Validity.
We're your hosts. My name is Guy Hansen.
And I'm Danielle Gallant, and this is Email After Hours.
Unless you've been living under a rock for the past couple of months, if you're an email marketer, you've heard of Gmail and Yahoo's new bulk sender requirements. These new policies, which focus on email authentication, unsubscribing, and complaint rates, were introduced to improve user and subscriber experiences. And in short, it's fair to say that they've caused some email marketers to panic. And maybe news of these new policies affected your email program and required some changes to be made, or maybe you were already ahead of the game. But either way, we are going to dive deep into these new policies on the pod.
So I think one thing I would say is, despite all the great education that Marcel and his counterparts have been doing over the past few months, it still feels like there's a load of confusion amongst big email senders about what the new requirements actually mean. So today we're going to take the opportunity to do a little bit of myth-busting about the new requirements. And to help us do that, we're joined by Marcel Becker, self-professed email nerd and senior director of product management at Yahoo. Marcel, awesome to have you with us today. Thanks so much for joining myself and Danielle on Email After Hours.
Yeah, totally. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys and, you know, chat about email and all the things around it.
Marcel, we're going to start the way we start every episode before we get into the meat and potatoes, which is with an icebreaker question. So you're in product management now, as well as a whole bunch of other things. But let's say you had the job you wanted when you were 5 years old. What would you be?
5 years, I don't know. But a little later on, I would probably be a pilot. Always wanted to be one.
Absolutely. I wanted to be a pilot when I was little, but hey, email marketing's a good second best option, I reckon. So listen, let's start with a question that's on most email senders' minds. You know, why? Tell us about why these new requirements have been implemented. Let's clarify the time frames being rolled out, because I mean, in theory, we're in February now. They are official, they're being enforced, but it's going to take a few months before we see the full impact, right?
Yeah, and these are like two questions in one, right? But focus on the first one. I would actually ask back, like, why not? When I look at them, when I look at why were the goal of those, I would say they make perfect sense. They're designed to protect both the users as well as the senders and the brands, right? To create a more secure environment for everybody. Specifically, when we look at DMARC, which is designed to protect brands and the domains and their domains from spoofing. But also on the other side, we really want to create just a better experience for our mutual customers. We want to make sure that our users receive the emails they actually care about. And we want to keep the crap out, you know, they do not care about and which can potentially harm them. All of these requirements in my book are like no-brainer requirements, email standards, which have been around for some time. In some cases for like decades, and, you know, implementing them on the sender side, honoring them, is just makes sense. It just creates a better environment, better experience for everybody. And then I think your second question actually was, what are the timelines? And as you said, that has been well documented by now, and everybody should be aware. As we said, in February, we'll start enforcing these requirements and standards and best practices. Doesn't mean, and I think that's very important to note, it doesn't mean that there is a single flag day. There's nobody at Yahoo or any other mailbox provider, you know, was or will be sitting there on a specific day and, you know, hit a button, a big red button, and then all of a sudden all mail gets blocked and nothing works anymore and sky is falling. Of course, that did not happen and that will not happen. It's a gradual rollout, right? You want to make sure, again, that our users receive all the emails they actually want to receive. We don't want to disrupt anything in any way, because that's not a great user experience either. And at the same time, obviously, we need to start enforcing some of these, right? As we've seen, just talking about these best practices and, you know, asking nicely did not work for the last 10 years. So we need to, you know, provide an incentive in a way in the form of acquiring these standards and email best practices to be implemented. So as we progress through the rest of the year, senders will see more and more deferrals maybe and relevant reject messages, SMTP reject messages, which would tell them specifically why we did not want to accept that email, why we deferred it, and it will spell out specifically which requirement was not met.
I have seen some of these already in working with clients. We've seen some of those deferrals, like the, I think in this case, it was a soft bounce code, like a 421 code, and then a very specific bounce reason. So you're right about that. And now that it's been a couple of weeks, at least by the time this podcast is going to be out, do you have any initial observations about what you're seeing?
Yeah, it's twofold. One, and I always find this hilarious in a way, is when you basically talk about new requirements or new standards or things which might or might not happen, then that day rolls around and then people, I'm not sure if this confirmation bias or I think it's called something else, something bias, because then people actually pay attention to things, right? And then they assume this is happening because of, you know, us or anybody else enforcing standards. And in reality, has nothing to do with, you know, new standards, new requirements. It's always been this way. For example, we have seen a lot of people complaining or asking about a specific SMTP error, and then a lot of speculation in this industry or sending communities like, oh, this is this new error. This means X, Y, and Z because Yahoo just rolled out this new thing. Like, no, this error has been around for like more than 10 years. It means the same thing it always meant. There's nothing new. But anyway, I think it's a good thing. Now people actually pay attention to some of these. And if it helps to create a better environment and if it helps to get senders to implement these standards, I'm all for it. And in that vein, we actually see improvement already. We see senders or more emails being authenticated. More senders are actually already supporting one-click unsubscribe, even though it's not enforced yet. So that is a good thing, right? We don't necessarily have to reject emails or press the red button, but people are already doing the right thing.
I think that's awesome to hear. And I think we'll touch on the individual requirements in a bit more detail in a moment. But before we do that, one question that keeps coming up time and again is the actual definition of bulk senders. And I know that this varies slightly between yourselves and Gmail, Gmail have hung a number to the post, you know, 5,000 emails a day. I know that Yahoo's definition of bulk sender is slightly more ambivalent, although probably still in the same ballpark, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why we did not give a number, and there's also a reason why I still do not want to give a number, because then with any information or details published somewhere, people try to interpret that in funny ways, or people try to basically argue that it's not them, right? It doesn't affect them. They don't have to do anything because they only send 4,999 or whatever. I think if you actually read through the FAQs Gmail published, they also try to clarify or walk back a little bit, you know, make it clearer that 5,000 is not a hard limit. It's around 5,000. So from my perspective, I would say a bulk sender is anybody who sends the same email to a lot of people, whether this is 1,000, 2,000, it really doesn't matter. I will also say, you know, if you're a bulk sender as a sender, I think you do. And even if you're not quite sure, just assume you are and implement these no-brainer best practices and standards, period.
Absolutely. And just building on that, because you spoke about FAQs, and I wanted to ask you a question about that, because in the Yahoo FAQs, you make a very interesting observation that in terms of how you think about a sender's total volumes, you are including the volumes associated with any spoofed emails that we're seeing that might be associated with that sender. That's correct?
That is correct. That's the reason why we want senders to authenticate their traffic, so we can actually better identify them and then cut down on these spoofed emails. But without any authentication, anybody who looks like you will just assume it's you.
Sure. A powerful incentive.
And we were already on the subject, so let's get into the new requirements now, one by one. First up, let's talk a little bit more about authentication. Now, people who are in the industry or are as immersed as we are of course, you know, well-versed in DMARC and what that means. And you joined us in a webinar a few months back, which we surveyed, and found that one-third of the audience was not prepared with a DMARC policy of at least P equals none. You've kind of alluded to this. Did everyone implement DMARC on time? And explain to us how and why DMARC benefits users for Yahoo and Gmail, and maybe senders too.
Yeah, let me start with the latter part, the why. DMARC is really designed to protect brands, first and foremost, from being abused and spoofed, which in turn helps our mutual customers to ensure they're only interacting with legit emails sent by these brands, right? Or in layman's terms, it's basically designed to avoid that anybody can send email as bankofamerica.com to our customers and scam them out of their savings. So that's what DMARC is for. And a lot of brands might think, oh, you know, my brand is not that important. We're not a bank or whatever, so I don't need to protect it. Well, the thing is, bad actors still use your good reputation and your domain to send scam emails, even though if they're not targeting your brand directly, if your domain is not protected, bad actors will still use it, right? And that will hit your reputation and that will make it harder for you to send your email. And it will also tarnish your brand reputation in the eyes of our consumers, because if they see an email coming from yourbrand.com, which is sketchy, you know, they would just associate that sketchiness with your brand. I don't think that's something anybody wants. So that DMARC was designed to do that. The first part of your question is, yes, we have seen before we started rollout already, and I think I shared this in the webinar, is DMARC adoption is not where it needs to be, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to enforce it. While we have a lot of emails being protected by DMARC, it's a very small set of senders who actually protect their email, which means the large senders, they have protection, which is great, but there's a very, very long tail of senders who do not have protections. And sometimes for the reasons I just laid out, right? Because they're like, yeah, I know about DMARC, but you know, I don't care. And then I think what we found after we announced the requirements, and even more so now, when everybody is in more of a panic mode than before, there is less knowledge in the industry, not just the brands or the email marketeers. I'm also referring to, you know, ESPs, people who should know about these things. And I would say there's less knowledge about what DKIM and SPF and DMARC actually is and how it actually works than I originally imagined. And that's not a good thing, right? Especially these so-called experts in the industry, people who sell email to brands and their customers and claim to be experts, don't seem to be. And that's not great. And that's something worth fixing.
Now, I'll tell you what, talking about the sort of disconnect between what people think and what the reality is, let's talk about the requirement for one-click unsubscribe. Because I've spoken to plenty of senders over the last couple of months, and we've talked about this, and they've gone, yeah, that's cool. We've got a one-click opt-out link in our email footer, and it's, hold on a second, that's not what Yahoo and Gmail are looking for. So do you want to walk us through that, Marcel, the actual header requirement that's RFC 8058 compliant?
Yeah, totally. And you hit the nail on the head there as well, right? And some of these confusions are thanks to just different definitions of these terms and words and what has been used on maybe a brand and marketing side in various contexts and what we have been using maybe on the receiving side or in the tech community. That's totally understandable, right? I can relate to that. It also means we need to clarify this a little bit more, and we use that as an opportunity to update our documentations and FAQs. And obviously, that's also one of the reasons why I'm happy to, you know, sit in the podcast like this or anywhere else and answer these questions, because I realize more education is needed, and not necessarily because people didn't do their job properly. But in this specific context, yes, unfortunately, there is the term one-click unsubscribe means different things to different people on different sides, or on two sides of the aisle, so to speak. And I would basically say what we would call traditionally a one-click unsubscribe in the body of an email is, in most cases, not a one-click unsubscribe, right? Maybe we should call this at least a two-click unsubscribe, because you usually need to click on the link in the email. And then you need to click a button. So that's two clicks, not one click. So what we're referring to in our requirements is what I would call true one-click unsubscribe. And that is usually the UI or button you see outside of the body, a button or a link, the email application actually puts next to the sender in the header of an email or even outside of an email, right? In some email applications, you might see an unsubscribe button in the message list, for example. Or at Yahoo, you can go to a what we call the subscription view or a subscription hub. You can see all the emails and brands you subscribe to, and you can unsubscribe from these brands with one click. And obviously, that button is not in the email. It's not the link in the email itself. How that works is by senders actually putting in specific headers in their email, not in the body, in the headers, specifically what's called the list unsubscribe headers, as you said, as is defined by RFC 8058. This means, don't want to go into too many technical details, but it's essentially an URL you put in there. Also an indication that the URL needs to be called by an HTTP post request. I will not go into more details here. People are interested. There are tons of information out there explaining it. But what it essentially means is if a person clicks the button in our UI or any of the email applications UI and says unsubscribe, it's a true fire and forget request, which means our application or our servers will make an HTTP post request to that URL telling the server there, unsubscribe this user. Don't render anything. Don't give me any page. Just here's the information, unsubscribe that user. Thank you very much. I'm out of here. And then the expectation is that the server on the sender side unsubscribes that user immediately from that email or email campaign or vertical, whatever the user should be unsubscribing from. And that's it. Through one click unsubscribe.
And while we're on this, because this is part of the way that this unsubscribe, one click unsubscribe header works, at least the one you're talking about, let's bust another unsubscribe myth. A question we get a lot is, won't we see an increase in opt-outs because spam filters are clicking on our links? Like, aren't we going to see that go way up if we have this one-click unsubscribe header in this specific RFC 8058 format?
A very short answer, no. That's why this was designed as an HTTP post request. So typically, when bots go through an email, anti-spam bots, whatever those might be, right? And they see an URL, what they do, they issue an HTTP GET request, right? Because they want to see what happens if, a user would click that link in a browser. And the specification of RFC 8058 very specifically states that if you get an HTTP GET request on that URL, you should not do anything, or you should, might even say you must, render an unsubscribe page. The same page you would render if for the unsubscribe link you put in the body. And then there you can do the same thing you do today, right? You can show a preference sender. You can do anything you want if you get an HTTP GET request. If you get an HTTP POST request, which is what bots do not do, what they shouldn't, in most cases they don't, then you're required to basically unsubscribe the user without any further confirmation.
Cool. Well, I think that's a great explanation. I think anyone listening to today's conversation, they were confused about that. Going to be a lot more clear now, folks. So finally, we come to the requirement around spam complaint thresholds, and the published guidance is 0.3%. Now, you and I chatted about this a couple of months ago, and you had some fairly memorable words at the time that, don't be too focused on 0.3%. If that's what you're getting at the moment, you're already going to be feeling a world of deliverability pain, I think was your words, Marcel. So should the way that we're actually thinking about this be you should never exceed a complaint rate of 0.3%, but the long-term average that you as a good sender should be aiming for is actually much lower? Would that be a fair way of paraphrasing it?
Yes, absolutely. So that threshold is also nothing new. It's just that we now talked about it. I recently saw somebody on LinkedIn posted some interesting little story and article basically equating that to rules a bar owner or the regulars basically post at the bar. The regulars already knew about these rules, even though they were not written, right? Everybody was following them. They were not new, but now the bar owner basically posted those rules, put them on the door so everybody could look at them. And then the non-regulars started freaking out because maybe they didn't know these are the actual rules, which have been around for decades. So, and that's similar here. We always looked at spam thresholds. We always deferred email if you were exceeding certain thresholds. We blocked or rejected your traffic if you continue to exceed these thresholds, right? That's just simply how anti-spam works. All our anti-spam filters work. If our users are telling us that that specific sender, DKIM domain, IP address, whatever, is, you know, it's constantly sending emails they do not want, we will start blocking you. That's not new. The only new thing now is that we put the number out there. And as I said last time, if you are hovering around that number today, even without any enforcement, you already have issues sending your emails. So none of that is new. And yes, you should not think, oh, if I stay below 0.29%, I'm good. No, you're not. You're as bad as 0.3%. And you should really, really try to get much lower, because the good senders, and that's the majority of the senders we see, they are way below 0.1%. And the average across all emails is way, way, way below that.
It's so interesting too, because in the webinars that we've had for this, and then in Q&A feeds, and even the questions we're posing to you now on the podcast, senders really are looking for hard lines. They are looking for, am I a bulk sender? Am I at 5,000 emails? Or is this a 0.3? Like, it's super strict. They're looking for something that's hard and fast when it really isn't that way. Like, this is about, you know, if you have to ask the question, you're probably a bulk sender, or it's not just don't exceed this certain threshold. It's super interesting. And I think in the vein of education that you talked about before, maybe every sender is not super familiar with how to monitor complaints effectively. Can you detail some strategies on how senders might be doing that or how they should be doing it?
Yeah, so certainly there are tools available today on most of the platforms. You know, on our side, you can subscribe to the feedback loop, or the complaint feedback loop, CFL for short. And you can actually look at how many emails are being marked as spam by our customers. So that should give you an idea of how healthy your traffic is. It might not allow you to directly compute like the actual spam complaint rate, but it should be an indication. And like I said before, if this is in the higher numbers, you're probably doing something wrong. Whether this is 0.3%, 0.2%, it really doesn't matter at this point in time. You should do something about it. Likewise, I know Gmail, they also have their Postmaster tools. But we also collectively realized that maybe we need to do more and give more signals, more data to senders. And I have been an advocate for that for some time, as I think at least you guys know on the validity side. So yes, there will be more tools available. We will do this in a meaningful way for customers. So I would say watch the space, both on the Google side as well as on the Yahoo's Postmaster tool side.
That's super exciting. We'll definitely be watching closely. Now, one final question on this topic. I think, you know, for years we've talked about almost the balancing act between complaint rates and unsubscribes, because I think we all know that most email subscribers know that both are, you know, a route to exit from an email program. And because human beings are lazy, they're generally going to take the route of least resistance. You know, whichever of those options is the easiest to use is the one they're going to choose. But of course, there's implications for senders, because every complaint has a negative implication for reputation and deliverability, whereas an unsubscribe is a far more neutral transaction. So you would hope that sort of senders are thinking, well, if somebody's going to leave my program, let's at least get them to exit using the unsubscribe route. Do you have any guidance for senders in terms of, you know, how they almost try to get some nudge behavior going there towards unsubscribing rather than complaining?
Yeah, let me answer this question a little bit more broadly, because I'm still amazed and surprised sometimes by conversations I'm having with senders when we say, hey, you should make it easy for users to unsubscribe. And then especially in the wake of us saying we require one-click unsubscribe, a lot of senders were like, but this is hurting our OKRs or our P&L and our goals. I'm like, huh? If you're sending an email to somebody and they say they don't want it anymore, they want to get rid of it, no matter what, period. So what do you think is the better experience and the better way to do that? Is it for the user or receiver to actually market a span, which does what the user wants at the end of the day? Or is it allowing these users to easily just unsubscribe from these emails, right? One way or the other, they want to get rid of your email and they don't want it anymore, right? They will not read it. But if they market as spam, it actually will impact your sender reputation. So this is much worse for you than the unsubscribe. And both will have the same impact on your internal OKRs or whatever goals you have. These people do not want your emails. We actually have seen that if we offer unsubscribe to our users versus market spam, even after they clicked on market spam, right? We have the UI in Yahoo Mail, other email providers have similar UI. A user who clicks on market spam, if we trust the sender, and if we see that you can actually safely unsubscribe from them, we will nudge the user and say, hey, do you want to unsubscribe instead? And we have seen that this actually decreases the spam votes by, you know, between 30 and 40% for those brands. And I think that's a good thing.
Definitely from a deliverability perspective, it's a good thing. That's for sure. And we've already talked about preparedness, I think, and how this is really, in reality, only moving from a we recommend to we require for all of these different things that were previously considered best practices. And something that I've seen, and I just kind of want to get your opinion on this, is that we've talked a lot about the marketers, the senders, and what they need to do and what they need to have as part of their email programs. But you touched on ESPs before and their preparedness too, because I know that they have also had to either make some changes or make some adjustments, even if it's to the amount of time it takes, say, to process and honor an unsubscribe request. Do you think at all that it's incumbent upon ESPs to have some of these things as requirements out of the gate for senders?
I would think so. I mean, that's at the end of the day, I think that's the goal, right? Just like ESPs or anybody who's allowing somebody to send email, be it personal email, be it bulk email, right? We do not tell any of those customers, consumers, be it on the business side or the consumer side, how email needs to work and that they need to set up certain DNS records and MX records and, you know, jump through certain hoops. It just works, right? There's a front end. There's a button, you can send an email and poof, magic happens. I would say this is a perfect opportunity for all of these ESPs, tools providers, platform providers to implement that magic into their platform, right? So senders should not worry about any of that. Just like they don't need to worry about all of the other basic email technology. And yes, I get it. In some cases, it's not that straightforward, right? It will be, especially when we talk about DMARC, who controls the DNS, who can set this up and all of these things. But I think there's an opportunity to come up with solutions which make this as simple as possible.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, talking about solutions, we've spent a lot of time today talking about the current state, but you're a huge advocate for best practices. And I'm sure you've got a few thoughts in terms of where you'd like to see these kind of requirements go next. You know, any thoughts in terms of how they might be tightened up further over the months and years to come?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the most important message here is this is just the beginning. This is not the end goal. We will not stop there because you can imagine just requiring DMARC policy of none for DMARC. That's not what DMARC is for. It doesn't protect anything. The end goal for a DMARC policy is obviously reject, because only then does DMARC what DMARC is supposed to be doing, which is, you know, protecting the brand's domain and reputation and the customers from interacting with scam and phishing emails. So I think senders, ESPs, everybody should basically treat this is the first step in the right direction in making email a better experience for everybody and making it a more secure environment for everybody and helping us and working together and just creating a more trusted environment. There's a lot of abuse happening in email. I always like to quote the fact that 90% of all emails we see floating around are spam and scams, yeah. Right? They're not legit. And we need to cut down on that, right? There's a lot of noise out there, a lot of garbage floating around in the email world, and that's not great. I believe email has the potential to be even more useful on both sides, for consumers as well as for brands and marketeers. But we need to make the necessary steps into the right direction to make this more secure and trusted, specifically for our mutual customers. So I would say expect more, not less. We need to work closer together to make sure we can actually create that trusted environment. I don't know. You know, in some other areas of the internet, people speak about if you want to participate in certain, you know, be it social networks or something like that, actual identification is required. Who knows? Might be a great idea for email as well.
Buckle up, everybody.
Buckle up and enjoy the ride.
That was so awesome. And we're going to start to move out of the individual requirements. But I have one parting question before we start to officially wrap up here. I got to go to my first MOG conference last October. Very exciting for an email nerd. So, Marcel, there's one coming up soon. Two questions for you. One, please tell people what MOG stands for as an acronym and what it is. We've done that before on the podcast, but I think we'll need a refresher. And I know what happens at MOG stays at MOG. But can you share any insider news on what might be discussed?
Yes, well, MOG or M3AAWG, I believe, which messaging malware mobile internet abuse working group.
Good.
It's to me, it's probably the biggest, but if not, definitely the most important gathering of people in the industry, be it on the sending side, receiving side, carrier side, like basically everybody who is involved in connecting people and brands and online communication, and just making sure that we do this in a very secure way. And we collaborate on email standards or initiatives to make sure we keep the bad guys out, right? In a nutshell. And then, as you said, right, you can imagine we will be discussing topics which, you know, we most likely do not want to share with others out there on the internet. But we also discuss topics there which help create this better experience for our mutual customers and make it better.
This has been such an awesome conversation today, and I'm so glad you've joined myself and Danielle to have it. We do need to start wrapping up, and we're going to throw a couple more quick-fire questions that you literally sort of one-sentence answers. But you've got this great view of the email marketing universe. Any thoughts in terms of your biggest aha moment from the past year or so?
Well, there were so many, probably.
I was going to say, you're spoiled for choice here.
No, I think what I said before, I think the biggest aha moment in the context of what we've been discussing today is just how little some players in the industry were prepared and how much work we still have to do in the industry. Collaborate and work together on creating that better experience and more trusted environment.
And mine now, my closing quick fire question for you. And usually we're asking like marketers about this. We don't typically ask this of people who are on the other side. But if there was one trend, like email trend or buzzword that you are just done with, you're ready to never hear about it again, what would that be?
I like buzzwords and trends. In many ways, you know, in many ways, this means like people care about this stuff or people are looking at new ways and maybe even innovation. And it usually pushes things forward. Sometimes I read certain words and terms on the marketer side and like, this is not a real thing or this doesn't really exist. But whatever, right? Go for it. I can't name a single thing.
Marcel is here for trends.
There we go. Once again, thanks so much for joining us. That's it for today. Danielle and I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Between now and then, we're both going to be traveling a bit. We're going to be on the speaking circuit doing gigs in Palm Springs and Miami. This job does have its perks, right, Danielle? And so we'll have a whole load of fresh new industry intel to share in another 2 weeks' time. Join us on Email After Hours then. Bye for now.
Thank you.
Be sure to tune in next time and hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And don't forget to visit senderscore.com for loads more great resources to help you become a stronger sender.
To all you sleepless senders out there, thank you for joining us after hours, and see you next time.